The Israel Report for the latest news and insights with Anthony Reich.
Anthony Reich, a very good morning to you. How are you?
Boker Tov, it almost feels like you've never been away, Howard.
not so much on this end, but still, it's nice to hear. And
some of the news, unfortunately, also feels like you've never been away. Again, alleged Israeli airstrikes near Damascus being reported this morning. Apparently, four soldiers were killed and three others were injured in what is being reported as Israeli airstrikes near Damascus, the third time this month that Israel is being accused of attacking a Syrian target. Apparently, Syrian air defenses, according to the reports that come from Syria, Syrian air defenses did intercept most of the missiles, most of the attack that was carried out against this particular target. However, for those very, very few missiles that somehow managed to wangle their way through past the Syrian air defenses, apparently there were four people killed and three others were injured. We are not exactly sure what the target was on this particular occasion, even though it seems as if though this was a target that was near to the Damascus International Airport. That's all we really know about at the moment.
Yep, and it's become so common that I'm now quite surprised even to see it reported as a headline.
Yeah, I mean, it is a headline, and it is being reported in the Israeli press, even though the sources
That's what I'm saying. When I look at Israeli press and I see it as a headline, I'm becoming surprised because it's almost that it's so common that it's becoming business as usual.
Yeah, it is business as usual, but I think it's also a message that's being sent to the Israeli public that, you know, first of all, you shouldn't assume that just because you don't hear about what's going on in Syria, that nothing's happening there. And I think the other message is very, very clear, is that even though we have these distractions, we've had unrest in Jerusalem and we've had rockets from Gaza and things like that, we're still on it in terms of what's going on in Syria. And don't think for a moment that we're less resting on our laurels to allow things to move freely within Syria and across Lebanon, Hezbollah, Syria, you know, Iranian forces, things like that. We're still very much active there.
No doubt about it. This is a very strange story about the Prime Minister, the security being increased after he received a letter containing a live bullet. What a strange story this is.
Yeah, and threats against his family. I mean, actually, it seems as if though the letter was not sent to him, but rather sent to the workplace of his wife, Gilat. That's what some of the press is reporting, that it was sent to her workplace. And it was a particular threat, not only against the Prime Minister himself, but indeed against members of his family. Now, the whole strange situation with the Prime Minister's setup, when you were in Ranana, you may have noticed what has become known as the Ranana Mukata, which is the area where Prime Minister Naftali Bennett and his family live. And they live in a regular neighborhood, nice houses around that neighborhood. And since he was elected as Prime Minister and he decided that he was going to stay living in his private home in Ranana, a whole security cordon has been set up around his home, including neighbors who live there, regular people who go about their daily business. They're all caught up in this whole security cordon around the Prime Minister and his private residence in Ranana. And not only that, but these people are also subject to protesters who come and make a noise there on a regular basis in the middle of the night and at all strange hours. Very, very inconvenient indeed. The police have tried to distance those protesters from the Prime Minister's home, but wherever those protesters happen to be, whether they be right next to the Prime Minister's home or a block or two away, there are other people who get disturbed by all the protesting and all the shouting and screaming. The Prime Minister's come under considerable threat from people who oppose the work that he's doing and some of the strategies, policies that he's been following. And unfortunately, this is a very, very serious escalation, I think, in the threat against him. When it starts to include members of his family, his son came out saying that his father is really a very good person.
Yeah, I saw
and
that show.
Politics is just unfortunately the business that he's in. but he's actually a very good person. And the Prime Minister himself put a report out saying that he happens to be not only the Prime Minister and a politician, but I am also a husband and a father, and it is my duty to protect my wife and my children. That was what he wrote. And then he went on to try to urge people from across the political spectrum, especially people who are active on social media, to lower the flames of political discourse, particularly in this period ahead of Remembrance Days and Independence Day. It's a time for calming and reconciliation, in the words of Naftali Bennett. The problem is that people feel so strongly about everything that happens here, whether you happen to fall on this side of the fence or that side of the fence, it doesn't matter what happens. There's always somebody who feels very, very strongly about what is happening, and in particular, what's not happening.
Right.
And so, unfortunately, we see this coming out, and I don't like to refer back to the tragic events that took place around former Prime Minister, the late Yitzhak Rabin.
Right, but they're relevant. But they're relevant because this is what happens.
Relevant.
Yeah.
They are very relevant. And, you know, once upon a time, the Shin Bet, who is responsible for securing the Prime Minister, was worried about Arab terrorists who might be people from outside of Israel who might risk the life of the Prime Minister. And yet these days, I just wonder whether that threat is not more internal than external.
Is there not pressure on the Prime Minister to leave Ranana and move to Jerusalem, where he can be better protected, where the system is set up better for him?
There is massive pressure on the Prime Minister to move his residence. Currently, we understand that the Balfour residence, the Prime Ministerial residence in Jerusalem, is being refurbished. And there's a lot of work going on there to upgrade it. Apparently, it was in the state of quite significant disrepair and it needed an upgrade. So that's what's happening at the moment. It's not clear whether the Prime Minister will actually move there once the residence is actually in a state to be lived in or not. And it seems as if, though, that is a decision that doesn't need to be taken now, because it's still quite far off in terms of how much time is still needed for the renovation of that residence. And let's not forget that this Prime Minister is only in office, theoretically, for another year and a little bit, until the changeover is supposed to take place and Yair Lapid is due to assume responsibility as Prime Minister. Having said that, once Naftali Bennett is already a former Prime Minister, he will still need to have a certain level of security around him for quite a significant period of time, even though he might no longer be in office. So I think that this situation is due to persist in Ranana, and there are court cases at the moment going on through the High Court of Justice about whether the Prime Minister's office has the right to set up that cordon and inconvenience other residents and the other neighbours who live there in the way that they have been inconvenienced. That is a case that's currently winding its way through our court system.
I was quite shocked when I saw that in Ranana, to the extent that this has impacted on what was a very quiet neighbourhood.
Right, absolutely. And I actually know people who live within that area and who are just really frustrated, not only by the inconvenience of the road having been closed off so there's no access, and people having been enclosed into the security cordon that they find it very difficult to move in and out, but also the fact that there's no parking in the area because it's all been made no parking, and also because drones are constantly flying around the area inspecting everything that's going on, including over their own private properties. There is a significant inconvenience involved in having the Prime Minister be your neighbor.
Absolutely. So it might sound cool in theory, but in practice, from everything I understand, it really, really is very, very inconvenient. Taking a look at some of the other stories, Israel's second astronaut, Eitan Stiba, has finally returned to Earth, and that happened on Monday evening. Tell us how this trip is being viewed.
So we didn't have I didn't have time to talk yesterday with Kathy about this, and we didn't have much time to talk during the week about what went on. He had been due to return already a week earlier, and the landing, the return to Earth, was delayed because of bad weather off the coast of Florida, where the splashdown took place, just off the coast of Fort Lauderdale, as I understand it, in Florida. And I actually watched the landing. It's an amazing feat of science to watch the rocket come out of orbit and re-enter the Earth's atmosphere. Dragon, as it's called, the SpaceX Dragon, re-enter the Earth's atmosphere, and then the reconnection, because they go through that period where they lose the communication, and then they reappear and the parachutes come up, and the way that the Dragon was then fished out of the sea, and the astronauts finally taken out of the capsule. It was all quite fascinating to watch. I think that, first of all, Israelis were very emotional and excited about the fact that on this occasion we had somebody to talk to, having been in Earth, because, of course, the previous experience back in 2003 was that, unfortunately, Ilan Ramon, Israel's first astronaut, did not return safely to Earth, as we all already recall. And so this time around it was different, and we're very grateful that it was different. He spent the whole of Pesach on the International Space Station, including a Pesach Seder, and of course he carried out a whole raft of experiments, including growing food in space and a number of other things, including Israeli school children. There was a massive project around it to try to involve the general public as much as possible to get them involved in some of the things that happened. There was a conversation that took place with the President of Israel, President Yitzhak Herzog, who had some words for Eitan Stieber. So all of it, I think, was very, very positive indeed, and it'll be interesting to see what the results of some of those experiments come out to be, and how we ultimately manage to use them to further science in Israel. But I think overall, this has been an amazingly positive experience, and we're very happy to have another Israeli astronaut having been up to the International Space Station on this occasion. And he happened to stay a week longer on the International Space Station than had been previously intended. Pesach in space, who would imagine that?
It's just incredible. It's probably was as remote as Pesach in Dubai, which is something that a lot of people enjoyed this year as well. So that is, it is quite, it's just quite bizarre, but incredible nevertheless. Changing tones, of course, tonight begins Yom HaShoah.
Yeah, so of course this is the period now when we go into the memorial days straight after Pesach. Just so that people recall, the reason that we have a memorial of Yom HaShoah now, as opposed to in January, when the international community, the United Nations, had International Holocaust Remembrance Day. The January date is there to coincide with the date upon which the Auschwitz extermination camp was liberated. And this date that we celebrate now more or less coincides with the date of the Warsaw Uprising, the uprising in the Warsaw Ghetto. And the significance is that whereas the January date is all about what the international community did for the Jews at that time to liberate the camp, this date, tonight and tomorrow, talks about what Jews did within the Shoah to try to help themselves, because there is this notion that, you know, we went like lambs to the slaughter. That's the term that's often used about what went on in the Shoah. And the truth of the matter is that there was a massive amount of resistance to the extent that it was possible. The resistance, of course, was very, very fiercely and cruelly dealt with, but there was resistance, and we shouldn't forget the resistance and the bravery of those people who did choose to stand up to try and fight this, most of whom unfortunately did not live to tell the tale, but nonetheless were willing to stand up for their rights and for their freedoms. And so that's what we will commemorate this evening when we go into nightfall. We, of course, will light candles. There will be ceremonies across Israel. And, of course, tomorrow we will have the siren. I'll talk a little bit about that in our discussion tomorrow, about how the siren works and how we will all stand for 2 minutes silence to think about those who not only fell, who were exterminated during the Shoah, but as one of the newspaper articles that I read wrote, also to remember those who survived the Shoah, because they also carry a mark. None of them can have come out of such as an experience without scars. Apparently something like 165,000 Holocaust survivors still living in Israel today, of course now all in their 80s and 90s. Some of them were survivors in slightly different ways than we expected. For example, people living in North Africa were subject to the Vichy government, the Vichy regime that ruled over France and also had its influence over North Africa, and some Jews living there were subject to the Vichy regime. There were others who actually were in concentration camps in North Africa that were set up by the Nazis, which we didn't get to hear very much about.
Yeah, so those people also counted in those.
Yeah, but they're also counted in as survivors of the Shoah. An interesting statistic that I was reading the other day is that on the eve of the Shoah in 1939, the world Jewish population at that point was 16.6 million. And now, 80 years or more later, the Jewish population in the world is not yet 16.6 million. Wow. It currently stands at 15.2 million. So we now, 80 years later, are finally kind of approaching the number of Jews that existed before the Shoah. People who thought that it would take a generation to regain the numbers were wrong, because it's taken much more than that, two, three, four generations in order to finally creep up. And we've existed over the last 60 or 70 years in what some people regard as the best possible period for Jewish existence in the world, with the State of Israel at our disposal and the way in which Judaism is protected and promoted by the State of Israel. There is a sort of a certain golden period for Judaism that is considered to exist right now, with Medinat Yisrael being available and the protection that it offers not only people in Israel, Jews in Israel, but indeed Jews around the world. And yet we still haven't quite got to the numbers of Jews that existed before the Shoah. It's an astonishing statistic to think about.
It really is, and it's something that makes it very, very tangible that we should think about this evening when Yom HaShoah starts. Anthony, as we said, we'll talk a little bit more about it tomorrow, what Israel looks like during this day and how Israel commemorates the fallen. It is about to go 8 o'clock. Thank you, as always. We'll chat to you tomorrow morning at 7:45.